Good morning. Carl Stimble texted me last night and asked me how I was doing on sermon preparation, and I answered him that I was unsettled and grateful, so I thought that's probably where God wanted me to be. It's humbling to talk to you this morning. Last time I talked to you, we were talking about the life of Saul. This morning we're going to talk about David. There's a concept in physics or in science, and I don't think I can give it full justice, but it basically is a wormhole understanding. And so what they say is that if this were space and time, and you could fold space, and you could poke a hole through it, you could go from one time to the other. Time travel would be possible, and teleportation would be possible. There'd be a portal to go from one thing to the other thing quickly. And so this morning, I don't know if I believe in wormholes, but I do believe in word holes, which I know it's kind of corny, but I do believe in that. I believe that there's a way to read the Bible that clearly transports us from one place to the next, because it's got prophecy, it's the Word of God, and it does crazy, wonderful things. This morning, if you would, I'd like for you to go to Mark chapter 2. If you've never been here before, rest assured I'm not the pastor. I'm just one of the guys on the teaching staff. And if I do something wrong, bring it up to Chris Kawa. Email him all week long if you want to. And I'd enjoy that. In Mark chapter 2, in verse 23 to verse 28, we see Jesus is with his disciples, and Jesus is on the Sabbath, and they're walking through a grain field, and the disciples are grabbing grains of wheat off the top of like little grass things, if you guys haven't seen wheat before, and they got them in their hand, but wheat has an outside covering on it, so they're kind of rolling it in their fingers, and they're trying to eat the wheat while they're walking because they're listening to Jesus, but they don't have time to stop and do anything else because he's on the move, and they're eating this wheat, and it's the Sabbath. Well, really, there's nothing wrong with that, but the Pharisees at the time had made the rules so strict on the Sabbath that you couldn't even, you know, get the hull off a piece of wheat in order to eat it because it's considered work, but it really wasn't what the law was about, but that's how much they'd strained at it, and they questioned Jesus and said, why do your followers do what's not legal on the Sabbath? Because they were experts in the law. And Jesus looks back at him and says, you know, the Sabbath was not made for man. Man was not made for the Sabbath. Basically saying, you know, this is about serving man. God had a plan for man, a refuge for man, a place of peace for man. And the Sabbath is about that. And you're missing the point. In fact, he goes on further to say in Matthew's account of it that if you understood what I want, what the mercy that I want, the compassion that I want from you, that's better than sacrifice. So the last time I talked to you, if you guys were here then, we talked about Saul and him having to understand that obedience was better than sacrifice. And this time, I'm just kind of teleporting you to the next section where we're talking about David, and we're going to understand that compassion, mercy, is better than sacrifice. And so we'll start there. And that's the place that we'll leave to go forward. Backward into 1 Samuel. I got a couple of things I'd like to set up. For all of you that are severely OCD, you would not be able to sit here the entire service and look at that, I know. So I'll just go ahead and take that one off for you, so you won't have to worry about that. And I'm just going to put a few things out this morning. If we were walking into the tabernacle or the temple, but this is the time of the tabernacle, which is a large tent, and we came in the courtyard would be the open area out here. In the first room, there would be the table of incense, the lampstand, and then there would be a table of showbread. And the table of showbread would have 12 cakes that were unleavened, not gluten-free. Each of the cakes would weigh about 5 pounds. They'd be about a foot around, a couple inches thick. And there would be 6 of them, stacked in 2 separate piles to represent the people of Israel, the tribes of Israel. And they would also be a remembrance before the Lord that God was their provider, that God was Israel's provider, and that was always before the Lord. And that showbread would be put on there fresh and hot on the Sabbath. And then every other Sabbath, it would be taken off to be eaten by the priests, and new hot bread would be placed out in order to eat it. Is anybody hungry? Everybody's hungry? A couple hungry? I mean, just hungry people. If you haven't had something and you need something, you're hungry? Have you washed your hands?
I have hand sanitizer.
Are your hands clean?
Yes.
You sure? Okay, you can have it. Anybody else hungry? Are you hungry? Have you washed your hands?
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else hungry? Oh, you're hungry? Have you washed your hands?
Sure.
Hey, you hungry?
Yes.
Have you washed your hands?
Yes.
You washed your hands?
Yes.
Okay. Have you washed your hands? Yeah? Okay. There you go. They're stale, Patrick. They're old. The date's expired on them. You don't want to. I bought them at Big Lots yesterday. First Samuel chapter 21. Okay. Last week, Pastor Chris, who is our pastor, talked about covenant relationship. Do you remember that? It was David and it was Jonathan, and they had pledged to each other and their families that they would keep this covenant relationship. And he went on to talk about marriage relationships being a covenant relationship, and he talked about Christ and us and that covenant relationship, God keeping his promises. So that's a good backdrop, because when we walk into this tabernacle setting, we have to remember that that's what it was a constant reminder of. That's exactly what it was. It was a constant reminder to the people of Israel of covenant relationship with God. And so that's where we're going to walk into today. Now, last week we heard, last week it ended with David finding out from Jonathan that things were as they seemed, and Saul was hostile to him. He'd already tried to kill him twice, and he tried to kill Jonathan when Jonathan brought him up. So we know it's not good. And David goes on to say this. He says, I am one step away from death. Now, he's not exaggerating. That's truthfully what he believes. So, I mean, you know, you guys, a bunch of Christians, you know, bam, bam! So two shots ring out in the back of the church right now. What would you do? I got a little bit out of you, but not much. But what would happen right now if shots rang out in the back of the church? Mass killings be what they're being, all the stuff you heard in the news. Right now, if you heard shots ring out in the back of that church, you'd start taking action, wouldn't you? Some of you would turn and face the offender. Some of you would get under your seats. Some of you would scream bloody murder. And some of you would run for every exit you could possibly find other than that. And the guys up on the top are going, I'm glad I sat in the balcony, because all that crap's going on down there and I'm not part of it, right? Well, that's what I want you to get the understanding of. It's imperative danger. Right now, David is afraid for his life, and he doesn't know where the danger for sure is going to come from, because Saul is in control of the entire land and he is in the land. So what does he do? He goes about 3 or 4 miles away to Nob. Nob's a really neat city. Nob has a bunch of priests in it. And the reason he goes to Nob is because in verse 1, he goes to Nob to speak to Ahimelech the priest. Now it says the priest, so you're thinking, what kind of priest? You know, what's he? This is actually the high priest. So he is the one that would be in the tabernacle officiating over everything. So Abimelech is the high priest. And the reason he goes to see him is because he's the captain of Saul's army. I mean, he's a really important military dude. And so the reason that he is going there is so that he can consult the priest, because he is looking for the next step. He's really wanting him to ask of God. And that's not unusual, because in chapter 22, we see that that the priest himself refers to David and says, it's not unusual he came to me this time. Many times I've seen him and consulted with him to give him what it is. So he is trying to find out now, what next? What am I supposed to do? Where am I going to go with this? What do I have to do? And so he goes to Nob to talk to Ahimelech. Well, Ahimelech, the word means brother to the king. So does that mean he sides with the king, or what does it mean? I don't know. The name is, that's just what it is. And his brother, though, was Ahijah. Ahijah was the military chaplain. He was Saul's, you know, main dude that hung out with him. If you remember from the story a while back when Saul forced the priest to pull his hand out of the ephod to find out the decision, that was Ahijah that he did that to. So he would then know, because his brother only lives a couple miles away, kind of what the demeanor of the court was, what Saul's attitude was with the spirit of that he had on him, the evil spirit, and kind of how he was acting. Those things would have filtered back to him. He would have known something about it. So when he sees David show up, he trembles and asks. And he says, why are you alone? And why is nobody with you? And that's a fair question. He's wondering what the heck's going on, because David should travel with entourage, right? He's an important military guy, so he should have people with him. So to see him by himself immediately raises suspicion. And so David's fast-talking. He's got to do something with this. He's got to get out of this somehow. So he really just needs to get the answers that he wants to get and get out of there. So what he offers in response to that, being the faith-believing person that he is and the slayer of a giant, he says, I'm on a secret mission from the king. And it's only on a need-to-know basis. And I've come here, and I've got some guys I'm going to meet out there, and they're hiding, waiting on me, and I just came to talk to you on a secret mission. That's called a lie. Now, remember, when we talked before, we had talked about Saul, and Saul did some lying, but David's in a different place. And you're going to kind of see this in this chapter, into the next chapter, but I'm going to go to verse 5 of the next chapter. So in the next couple of weeks, as we go through David's wilderness experience, we'll see more of this. But he lies. He says, I'm on a mission from the king, and that's what I'm doing. So what do you have on hand, Ahimelech? Do you have any bread handy, anything you could hook me up with? I'm looking for something, whatever can be found. Well, Ahimelech is serving. So he's got the ephod on. He's actually serving as a high priest. So where would he be at, y'all? You can talk. Come on. I already had the first service. They didn't wake up till like at the end of the service. So you guys have been awake for a little bit longer. So where was he at? He's in the tabernacle, right? So he's got the ephod on. He's serving in the tabernacle. This is not his house, right? There might be food stores, other places in the town of Nob, but Nob is a city of priests. There's 85 priests that wear the ephod, which means they actually serve in the temple itself. And then there'd be the tertiary supporting people, all the people that help with that, you know, herd cattle and do all the stuff and help out, clean stuff out. All those Levites will be there. And this is in the town that they're in. So when he comes to Ahimelech's like in the temple, and he's trying to get an answer from him. And while he's in there, he says, what do you got on hand? What can I have? Well, the only thing they're going to have on hand is going to be the showbread. Now, there's two different showbreads. There's the showbread that's fresh, and there's the showbread we just took off, okay? And there's 85 priests, and they get to eat that showbread when it comes off the table. So, you know, being men, they're probably all looking forward to bread day, which is on the Sabbath. It's already cooked. They don't have to cook it or anything. It's already been made. It is a week old, and it is sprinkled with frankincense and some spicy stuff. So I'm not sure exactly what it tastes like. Probably not like a donut. But anyway, they look forward to that day. 85 of them, 12 cakes, 5 pounds apiece, 12 and a quarter ounces a person. So that's a couple pizza crusts. Guys could put that away pretty quick. So it's there still. The showbread that's been taken off, the week-old showbread that's been taken off that the priests would eat is still in the tabernacle. So that means it's not 6 days later, it's not 5 days later, it's not 4 days later, it's not 3 days later, it's not 2 days later, it's the day of. So if David is at the tabernacle, then David traveled to the tabernacle on the Sabbath. And I looked that up. I'm pretty sure that's right, that he had to travel to the tabernacle on the Sabbath, and he gets to the tabernacle, and he is asking for something, and he gets the showbread. And the showbread that's there is really belongs to the priests. And so Ahimelech is in mercy and compassion for his need. His need. He needs food to sustain him. He has not eaten because he was hiding in the bushes waiting on Jonathan to tell him what's up. So he has not had anything to eat, and he's hungry, and the guys with him are hungry. He's the anointed one of Israel. He's the one that is to be king, and he has not had anything to eat. And God has a divine plan for provision that this bread that he instituted way back there as part of the tabernacle, and that he's going to talk about way out there when he's himself as Jesus walking on the earth. He has designed that particular day in Nob, that bread's for David, and God has provided it. And so technically, this is breaking the law, but it's not breaking the law because God intended for the Sabbath to be for man, not man for the Sabbath. He intended this provision to be his display to man and to provide for man, not the opposite. So while the priest could eat it, Ahimelech took the liberty, which is justified, and Christ validates when he talks about it, to give this food to the men who need food to live. And so he shows the mercy and compassion that Christ is referencing. Well, he gives that food to them, but there's only one thing about this food. It's not glazed, but it's consecrated. But any younger folks know what consecrated is? That means much younger than me. I mean, even though I'm young, like I'm thinking under 12. Does anybody know what consecrated means? I won't go on until somebody tells me what consecrated means. Come on. Anybody, consecrated. Somebody jab your kid and tell me what it is on the side so I get an answer. It has to be under 12. I've got under 12 that can tell me what consecrated means. Holy. Yes, that's right, Kennedy. Thank you very much. That was Kenny, wasn't it? Yeah. Okay. No, it's not Kennedy. Who's that?
Christy.
Oh, hey. Good to see you. Sorry. Okay. So it's holy bread. And so the priest merely thinks, I need to at least state the stipulation. I want to make sure you're clean, kind of like I asked you guys to get donuts if you'd washed your hands or not, if you were clean. And some of you may have stretched the truth because you were looking at the donut and really you wanted that donut and you really would do anything to get the donut at the time. So maybe you may have said something you shouldn't have. Right here, it says he asked David, he says, well, it's consecrated bread and you can have it, but only if the young men have kept themselves from women. And David says, well, surely women have been kept from us previously when we set out on, and the bodies of the vessels of the young men were holy, though that was an ordinary journey. So this today, this special mission that we're on, how much more holy are they? So yeah, oh yeah, and this is super holy today, is what he says. So I got to go PG on this. So what happens is in Levitical law, there's a rule about emissions from the body that then states that if you're going to be holy, you have to make sure that you're clean. Really, the point of this being that it is not God that makes us holy. It's what comes from man that makes him unclean. And we see that in a lot of different texts where it talks about what comes from the heart, what comes out of the mouth, and other things. And Jesus makes that point several times. So then this, it's a reminder as the priest is talking about this being holy and what holy means. It's God's message on the side that's saying to David, are you clean, David? Are you clean? David's already lied. And David responds with another lie. And you know that this is God already starting the wilderness experience for David, where he's starting to chisel on these things in David, and the humility is going to happen, and God's working. But David still, by hook or by crook, is going to get that bread because he needs it. He needs that 60 pounds of bread, 5 loaves, 60 pounds of bread to carry back to the guys that he's with so they have food for their journey to do whatever they're going to do next. He's sure, and he does need it. He does need sustenance. He does need food. But the message really is that I'm really your provider and I'm really all you need. And what I'm asking of you is clean and you're not giving it to me. But God in his mercy provides David this. And we see that later when David writes the Psalms and he's praising God. He says, the first thing he starts off with is goes, be merciful to me, God. He knows, not because I deserve it, not because I deserve this, but God, provide for me. But when I ask for it, I know the first thing is said, be merciful, because you are a merciful God, and that's what I know it to be. So that's what he asks for. So David responds with the lie and says, even more so now that we're clean. But remember, he's in a hurry. He's on a mission. And P.S., he's about to ask for a weapon. He didn't have time to pick up a sword or a weapon, but yet his men had 3 or 4 days to make sure that they were clean and pure before the Lord and the relationships with their wives and everything else. And you're like, doesn't really sound plausible. But that's the nature of the lie. And I'm at this point, I think Ahimelech is kind of going, yeah, all right, whatever. And then he hands off the bread and then David takes the bread. So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, for there was no other bread except the bread of presence that was removed from before the Lord in order to put the hot bread in its place when it was taken away. Now, one of the servants of Saul was there that day. And I hate to do this. I know I'm putting two things together that really don't go together in your mind, but this is the way I free associate. You just have to deal with it. Picture the Western, and the guy goes through the swinging doors into the saloon, and he saddles up to the counter, and he says, I have a bottle of sarsaparilla. And he's drinking his sarsaparilla, and he looks up into the mirror, and he sees the reflection, the guy in the black hat. It's Doeg the Edomite. So Doeg the Edomite is he's a rancher, if you would. He is the chief of Saul's shepherds. Now, when I said Doeg the Edomite, that's not like his first name and his last name. Edomite is his nationality. Now, if you'll remember back a couple sermons when Pastor Chris was talking about the empty victories of Saul, one of the empty victories of Saul where he conquered something was Edom. Saul had beat the snot out of Edom. And somehow in that, Saul, our trophy guy who brought back a king he wasn't supposed to bring back, also brought back this chieftain over his herds, Doeg. Now, Doeg is a backstabbing, sorry, sidewinder, you know, classic black hat villain, you know, in this story. And I guess maybe that's what he is. Not that he wouldn't be redeemable, but he's not in the story. And so when he comes into the story, we immediately know that one thing is he's in the city of priests and he's an Edomite. But that doesn't make sense, right? Because why would he be there? But it actually says he was detained before the Lord. So either he was getting caught up in some kind of judge legalistic system where he had to meet some criteria in order to do whatever he had to do. It was associated with his job. Or maybe there was a slaughter of some of the cattle that he had to be there for that. Or there's some reason. But God, in his plan, has Doeg in Nob at the same time that David shows up. So when Ahimelech's trembling, it might be because he's afraid that, you know, David's up to no good, or he might know what's going on, or it might be that he knows Doeg's back there behind him and David showed up and he fears Doeg. You don't really know what all the dynamics are, but we know some of the characters that are in the space. So Doeg's there, and David says to Ahimelech, "Is there a spear or a sword on hand?" Now, if you were in ancient Israel and you were like trying to pick up a 50 cal machine gun somewhere, you would not go to the Sisters of Charity. Okay, so this is the same thing. He has gone to Nob. This is the Levites, and the Levites are not responsible for fighting the battles. They're the tribe that's responsible for the temple and all that stuff. So really not an arsenal in Nob at all. It's not the place you would go to find that. And literally, a 50 cal machine gun is what comes out here because it's the sword of Goliath. Okay, Goliath was a huge man. His sword weighed an enormous amount. So in order for David to wield the sword of Goliath, he would have had to use two hands. It would have been made out of iron. It would look like a curved sickle. It was a killing melee machine that he recognized. Now, remember, when he came to the tabernacle, he needed food. He's now asking for a sword. Let's go back to the story of David Goliath. When he saw that sword the first time, it was strapped to the hip of a guy that was over 9 feet tall, who had a weaver's beam of a staff and a shield and 120 pounds of scale armor on the front of him and was defying the entire army of Israel. And David walked out with a slingshot and said, "I'm going to kill your sorry butt and I'm going to cut your head off when I'm done, because the Lord God of Israel has delivered the victory into my hand because you have defied him and the armies of the living God." So that's what David said when he saw it. And that's the first time he laid eyes on that sword. And the first time he grabbed that sword was when he took it from his laid cold body and actually killed him, because the stone just knocked him out. The sword took his head off and killed him. And so that's what happened. So now David is on the run from Saul, who he used to work for, and he's the anointed king of Israel, but has not taken the position yet. He's got enough food to live on, and he is asking for a sword, and he's offered Goliath's sword, and he says, "Yeah, there ain't another one like that one. That's the one I want." And he takes it away. How'd the sword get to the temple? Well, we know it's wrapped in something that's behind the ephod. It's not behind the high priest ephod, because that bad boy is like 4 feet long and you couldn't walk around with this thing stuffed up over the front of your robe. There's no way. So it was behind, the word ephod could also mean a curtain. So it was behind something. It was somewhere in there. But how did it get there? Well, we know at the end of it, when he killed Goliath, that he took all of Goliath's stuff, the spoils of the wind, and took them and put them in his tent. But that's not his tent. So he had to, at some point, have gone to the temple and tithed or offered a portion of what he had gotten off of Goliath in battle to the tent, and it had to be the sword, because if it had been the sword and the spear, then he would have said, yeah, I got the last sword and spear. No, he says, I just got the sword. So that means that David, at some point, when he had visited Ahimelech, like he already said he did a lot, he had given that sword over to the Lord, dedicated it to the Lord, realizing what about that sword? Well, he said it. He said, I don't need a sword. When he was on that field, he said, I don't need a sword. God's going to give you in my hand. So now he's picking up the sword, that everything about that sword means, I don't need a sword. God will give me the victory. He's picking up a sword that means the opposite of what he had said before. So I would propose to you that God gave him bread. God had ordained to give him bread, and that's what he wanted to do for David to sustain him. But David took the sword. He had given the sword to the Lord, and he took the sword back up. We don't ever see David with the sword again, because ultimately he loses it pretty quickly. But he picks the sword up because he is holding his own ways. And that happens in our own lives. There are times in our lives where there's certain things that we're trying to manipulate, like David's trying to manipulate the circumstances right now, and we just clamor at it and say, I got to have this. And some of those things aren't good for us at all. I mean, it could be something as simple as trying to, parents, control your child, trying to live vicariously through your child and think that's the thing that's going to achieve something. It can be wealth. It can be power. It can be a lot of good things. It could be theology. It could be, you know, the knowing all about this, and then, well, I've got it because I know this with my head, even though it says faith like a child. It's those kind of things that we'll go to as our crutch, those things that we'll grab and pick up that aren't necessarily bad things, but in our lives, they're things that enslave us or take us in a place that we don't need to be, take us to a place that's not faith-driven, but it's just manipulation of our own. The sword of Goliath. So he says, you know, there's not another one like it. And so the priest says, the sword of, verse 10, David arose and fled that day from Saul. So let me do a directional, I'll do the directions in a minute. But he's 3 miles north of Saul, and now he's got to get the heck away from Saul. So he decides to go east to Philistia because, you know, if he gets out of the land that Saul controls, the land of promise, the land that God gave them, the land that's their heritage, if he gets out of that land, then he could be somewhere safe. And so he's really thought this out, and he decides that he'll go to Gath. Gath, for those of you who don't know, is where Goliath is from. So he has the sword that he took from Goliath's dead body in his hand, and he goes to Gath. When he gets, well, what's in Gath? Well, there's Philistines in Gath. I get that. There's all the, you know, veterans' wives of the dead Philistines that David slew in battle. They're in Gath. And there's 4 other giants in Gath because Goliath got some relatives. So he's going back to Gath with the sword that says giant killer on it. And he's walking into Gath to the king of Gath. The king of Gath is Achish. The generic name for the king of Gath, and this is confusing, would be Abimelech. The high priest's name was Ahimelech, means brother of the king. Abimelech means son of the king, or just basically means have the right to the throne. It's a generic title where it's just what it is. But it's confusing, so I'm throwing that out there for you. So he goes back to Achish, goes to Gath where Achish is, and he hears what a guy with a big sword doesn't want to hear. He hears them saying this. He says, isn't this the one that they sang the song about? Saul has slain his thousands and David has slain his 10,000s? You know, that might sound really good and play really well in Israel, but when you're in Philistia and you're hanging out with that sword, that's really not what you want to do. And so being the brave, faithful, rugged man that David is, he decides to act like he's crazy. So that's what he does. He decides to disguise himself. I don't know if I can completely condemn this as a lie. It's a ruse. I don't know if it's a complete lie, but he decides to fake that he's crazy in order to get out of this. And in that time period, if you have some level of insanity or mental distress, they would have assumed that you were touched by the gods, or it was kind of like a bad omen for them to kill you. So they really wouldn't mess around with somebody like that. So the king's looking at him going, you know, I got enough crazy people. I don't know what kind of inbreeding was going on in Gath, but they got a lot of giants. They got six-toed people going on, and they might have a few crazy people, but something's going on in Gath, and he doesn't want any more crazies in the city. So he basically drives him out of the city. Right. We go from walking in with a sword to the city of giants and enemies, to being driven out without a sword on his own because he was acting like he was crazy when he walks out of Gath. It's all good. See, because this is the deal. David had it pretty good there for a while. I mean, you know, at an early stage in life, he's pulled off killing enemy number one of Israel, established himself as a man of God, been anointed by the dude, Samuel, and is going to be king. And now he's had a problem with Saul because Saul's got this evil spirit on him and he hates David and wants to kill him. And he's been pushed out of what he knows and he's in a place that he doesn't know at all. He really doesn't know what's coming next. He has no idea and he keeps trying to figure it out. And God's got him in this place for a reason because the ultimate is when you don't know what's next, I got you. You've got to trust me in this place. So it's a faith-building exercise. And David, when, I don't know, you tend to want to think that somebody who could kill a giant on an open plain with a slingshot wouldn't need a faith-building exercise. But that's us, brothers and sisters. That's us when we get to this place that things happen in our life and we start to develop a Christian confidence of some sort. God is so faithful to take us to places that are painful, places that are despairing, and places that are difficult. C.S. Lewis said that God whispers us to us in our pleasures and he shouts to us in our pain because that's what God's doing. God is about sculpting this. And C.S. Lewis doesn't say it from an easy place. If you know his life, he went through a dark period that God spoke to him in the same. So that's where David is. He has come out of Gath. And I think that the flannel graph illustrations of David and Goliath should always have another illustration showing David with his spit coming down his beard and him doing graffiti on the walls because that's the way he walked out of Gath. Now, did his ruse get him out of Gath, y'all? Is that what got him out of Gath? Is that what you believe? Because if you believe that, you believe that it was the slingshot that won on the field. The bottom line is God delivered David from Gath. God provided for David. David picks up a sword. God delivers David from Gath. So David comes out of Gath and he goes to caves of Adullam. The caves of Adullam are below Bethlehem and would be close to where his family was and his parents were quite old. So then we see as he leaves out of there and goes, we're in verse 1 of chapter 22, he escapes the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's household heard of it, they went there to him. And everyone in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him, and he became captain over them. Now there were about 400 men with him. Now, if you don't believe me about God chiseling on David, if you don't see that him making him run from Saul and go and beg for food because he had none. And if you don't see that him going to Gath with the sword and then being completely embarrassed about who he was and fear striking his heart so much that he acted like he was insane, that he let spit drop on his beard and he drew on the walls, and then ultimately being driven out of Gath with a big loser, you know, pasted to his back because he just really was yellow streaked there as he comes out of there. He walks out of town dejected. If you don't believe that was enough, then he sticks him in a cave with all his family. Remember his brother? What are you doing here, wussy boy? Aren't you supposed to be keeping the sheep? I mean, there's a little bit of animosity going in that family, and there's a lot of them. So I don't know. A bunch of brothers together can tend to be a little bit difficult with each other. And then your mom and dad are there. And oh, by the way, 400 other dejected, homeless people that have got issues and stress and all the other stuff, they're all in this cave with you. You know, it's a hotbed. Yeah, it would be very difficult to be in that position. So there they are. They're in the caves. And David's trying to figure this out. He has gone to hear from the Lord in Nob. Now he's here in this place. His parents have heard about him and come. And his brothers. He's got other people coming. So now he becomes captain over these people. So he's got some forces. But he's already learning not to trust the strength of men and not to trust those things, but he's learning to trust the Lord. And so he's in this cave, and then he decides, I've got to do something for my mom and dad. I've got to maneuver them out of this. It's not like mom can ride the back of a camel at 70 miles an hour. She's got to be away from this conflict. I can't protect my family at the same time. So he's trying to figure out what to do. So he leaves. This is the map right here, y'all. And you got Nob up here, and Gath is over there by, you know, kind of toward the coast in Philistia. On the other side of Israel, over there, is Edom. And Edom, you have to kind of either go down across the Dead Sea or kind of down around the bottom through and get up into Moab. I'm sorry, I said Edom. I meant Moab. Over here. So that's what he does. He crosses back across Israel, really, you know, tiptoey, to get to Edom, to get his parents to Edom. Moab, sorry, I did it again. Yeah, it's like me last time. I had Paul and Saul. I was wearing it out. Okay, so he goes over to Moab. When he gets there, he talks to the king, and he tries to barter a deal with the king, saying, "Hey, can you just watch my parents, you know, and keep them under protection until I find out until I know what the Lord's going to do for me?" So he's already changed his attitude. You can tell it in the demeanor as he asks for this, and so that's where he goes. Well, God's again provided for David in advance. God's provision here is that David has a relative. Her name is Ruth. It's his great-grandmother, and she was a Moabite. So he has actually relations with the Moabites, and it would be a political tie that he could actually appeal to them because he has Moabite blood in him, and therefore, when he goes to the Moabites, it's not by chance. God has already worked this out ahead of time. So he goes there, and that's what he does. He leaves them there, and then he goes to a stronghold, and he's still trying to figure out what to do next. But we know something's happened different because the next thing that happens for David is in verse 5. The prophet Gad said to David, "Do not stay in the stronghold. Depart, go into the land of Judah." And so David departed and went to the forest of Hareth. So why is that important? Well, he wasn't in Judah. He was outside the land again. He'd gone to Philistia. Now, if you think about it, what's God's promise here? God promises a land for the people of Israel. And David's the anointed one of Israel. And so that promise is definitely on David as much as it's on anybody else, if not more so, that they were promised a land. And when he leaves the land and goes to Philistia, he self-exiled himself. God never told him to leave the land. Like, when God's displeased and you haven't done what he's asked you, he puts you out of the land, but he didn't do that to David. So David went there. So then David left, went across the land, and went back over to Moab, right, Jamie? Went to Moab, and when he got to Moab and worked out the deal there, he kind of just stayed in a stronghold, but he's still in Moab. And so God's faithful and merciful, and in that he goes and sends a prophet named Gad to give David the word, which says, you're not supposed to be here. You're supposed to be in the land of promise, the land of my provision. That's where you're supposed to be. Well, why is that a problem? Well, because that's where Saul has domain, and that's where Saul's in control. And since Saul's in control of that land, David is going into danger, but David is in the land of promise. You see how that has to happen. So we're in the same place, right? There's a couple things here I'm sure you could apply. One is that, like the sword, we pick up things in our life. There are things that we're not supposed to cling to that we do. And there's also times where we will try to retreat. I remember one time in small group, a person was just kind of recounting the things that had happened in their life that were difficult. And they were difficult, justifiably difficult. And they were talking about it, and they said, you know, and that's kind of why we've just kind of pulled back and, you know, retreated to this place. And that's not what God's called us to. I there are periods of rest. There is refuge. God has places of refuge for us. But God's never called us to go out of his purpose or out of his will or retract from doing what he's asked us to do. He has a purpose for us. He has an anointing on us. He has set us aside. He has consecrated us. He's been our provider for a purpose to accomplish the mission and to take the land. And so that's where the message was for David from the prophet Gad. How gracious of God to communicate that message to David when David was not really doing the stuff he's supposed to be doing, but God was about chiseling this humility out of him. And David becomes a type of Christ in that he becomes a king who's learning humility. Christ, you know, the ultimate humility. One thought I'll throw on top of this is I kind of came to me last Sunday. Do you remember the cities of refuge? Is anybody familiar with that? The concept in the Old Testament law was that you could escape if you'd killed somebody accidentally. You know, if you threw a rock through the window at your friend's neighbor, but it actually hit your friend and killed him, then you didn't mean to kill your friend on purpose, and so that was accidental. And you can run. Or, you know, modern day, if you were out hunting and you accidentally shot somebody and killed them, didn't kill them on purpose, but you were careless and your shot killed somebody, then you could run away to a land of refuge, to a city of refuge. And so they had this law that said you could escape to a city of refuge if you'd killed somebody accidentally. Well, David hasn't killed anybody accidentally. But what I thought of with David, though, is that he went to Nob to find out something. But once he got out of Nob, he's like, what do I do next? What's next? Where do I go? What do I do? And there wasn't a place of refuge for him. There wasn't a place of peace for David. But if there had been, if he'd accidentally killed somebody and gone to a city of refuge, then he had been fine. He could have stayed in the city of refuge his entire life, not had to worry about anything. Nothing could happen to him as long as he stayed in the city of refuge. And the only way that all would be forgiven and that he would have freedom and be allowed to go anywhere he wanted to go was if the high priest died. When the high priest died, he was free to go anywhere he wanted to go. So that the image of the city of refuge to remind us of what that looks like. And in Hebrews, it basically says that we have that point, that that's what God has done for us, so that he has made for us that kind of situation. It says the main point, sorry, chapter 8, you're not going to look it up. Chapter 8, verse 1, the main point has been said is this: we have such a high priest who has taken a seat at the right hand of the throne of God on majesty and high. So we have that refuge. And so there's a saying in the Jewish community, which is very common. It's almost a greeting, and it's Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat means peace. I'm sorry, Shabbat means Sabbath, and Shalom means peace. And so basically it's saying the peace of Sabbath to you, right? So let's go back through our wormhole. We leave there, we go back to where Jesus was, where he was talking to the Pharisees about the disciples and their taking of the grain and saying, I want you to understand mercy is what I've called you to. It's not the law. It's not your sacrifices. It's the mercy. It's the love of man, and it's my love for man and my provision for man for him to find Sabbath rest. And he goes on further to say, the Son of Man, that's me, is Lord of the Sabbath. I provide Sabbath rest. And when he says it that way, he says, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Since the Son of Man was a reference he used himself several times, and is Lord of the Sabbath, it was a deity statement, because the Sabbath was established at creation by Creator God. And when he said he was Lord of that, he wasn't under Creator God, he was equal. And at that point, he has said, I am Lord of the Sabbath. And so this Lord of the Sabbath then is offering us peace. And so, you know, what does that look like? Well, it's in his provision. It's in this table. The thing I didn't mention earlier, which I think I mentioned now, is that special to the time that David came to the tabernacle, it was the Feast of New Moon. The new moon is when, if you don't know your lunar at all, a new moon is when the moon has gone all the way to nothing, and it's that dark night where you don't see any moon before it starts to open back up again, going toward the moon. That's the darkest night. In the darkest night, and they would celebrate on that Sabbath, they would celebrate the table a little bit different. There'd be different drink offerings and stuff like that would pour out before the Lord. One of the drink offerings that would have been present in the tabernacle at that time would have been wine. So when David got the showbread, there was wine in the tabernacle. The bread and the wine was present. And Jesus, giving himself for us in that ultimate peace, does the same thing. One other thing, I'm always like, what's the skeptic see in this? I don't know why I'm wired that way. But because I want, if there's a skeptic here, I want him to know Jesus, I guess. I want you to know him, and I want you to know his fullness. is that Jesus refers to the high priest as Abiathar. And Abiathar was not the high priest. Abiathar was the son of the high priest when David came to the temple. But he doesn't say that Abiathar was the high priest when David came to the tabernacle. He just says, in the time of Abiathar the high priest, which means in his lifespan, because Abiathar was like a pretty big character by then, and he would have been well known. He was a folk hero of sense because he ran around David after that and stuff. So in the time of Abiathar the priest, well, I was kind of okay with that. I settled on that. I thought that, hey, that's great. But the meaning of Abiathar instead of Abimelech, because remember, Ahimelech was my brother is the king, right? Abiathar means the divine father is preeminent, the father of plenty. Happy Father's Day. I just thought that was the most wonderful thing because I'm running through all the scripture and just one name just set my heart aglow because I just went, duh, I get it, right? All this provision, and when Jesus references all that provision that David did and all the stuff that happened in the Old Testament, when he wants to talk about it, he doesn't reference it haphazardly. God, Jesus just doesn't make a mistake. He picks that name because that name specifically is a hyperlink to say, this is who I am. This is who I am. So I'm thankful. If worship team, if you guys want to come forward, that'd be great. I'm thankful for fathers. I'm thankful for Harry Evans, my father, who shared with me who Christ was and lived it out over and over again, who I rebelled against, back-mouthed, hurt, caused him to pray over and over again. I say that I improved his prayer life. In our pain and in our weakness and in our despondency and our wondering what's next, there's only one person to ask, and that is God. And so David was asking God. And this wilderness experience really drives home the fact that David really started talking to the Lord. And then that produces this praise that comes out in the Psalms that we see over and over again. And that's where we're at. I asked the worship team to change the closing song because I want you to sing He Will Hold Me Fast Again, because I want you to sing that song. Hopefully at some point in this message today, you've lived through where David's at. And when you sing this song, I want you to sing this as David would sing it, and as you realize the pit that he's taken you out of and the despair that he's delivered you from, express it out of that. Thank you.